anyway, so I just wanted to thank everybody for coming. It's kind of a nice little cozy group, and this is a great location to have it in this nice little cozy room in this beautiful old hotel. And so I just want to thank everybody for coming, and I think everybody got your little brochure that Burnett put together so lovely. It shows us everything that's coming up, and I know my family's been appreciated. It even has the menus so we can, our mouths can elevate as we look forward to the next meal. We're going to start our morning with Gage sharing about the Depression, and it's really interesting because hearing the stories from my dad, the thrifty Cornish, who always had something put aside and always made things do and had a little garden, they really got through the Depression really well. And so it sounds like Gage's book is going to share even more about how the Cornish everywhere got through the Depression. And then after that, Dr. Gary Trogidja, close as I can say, is going to talk a little bit about virtual studies. So now we don't have to go to Cornwall to learn more about our Cornish heritage and to do some study on the Cornish in Cornwall through the University of Exeter. And then I hope everybody will stay for our business meeting after that, especially since we have a small group and we can look at the past year and the coming year and hear a little bit more from our next president, Kitty Quell, about our gathering in Placerville next year. So I'd like to introduce our wonderful local expert, Gage McKinney.
Thank you, Julie Beth. It's nice to see everyone here this morning.
Oh, you're going to take that with you?
I think it's probably here.
And I've written a book called The 1930s, No Depression Here. Copies conveniently on sale at the gathering.
And autographed, I bet.
Yes, yes. One has already been sold this morning to Wesley. And this is the story that the book tells. This is the story of how a depressed rural region in the 1920s was unexpectedly transformed after the stock market crash of 1929 into a scene of vibrant activity and record employment. Gold from the richest mining districts in California made boom towns of Grass Valley and Nevada City, while the rest of the country staggered under the burdens of unemployment, financial failure, and collapse. I've written about the 1930s in Grass Valley and Nevada City and the surrounding area, which was known at that time as the Northern Mines. And it included the economic sphere around Grass Valley and Nevada City that extended all the way up the slope into Sierra County and Plumas County. And it's a story that runs completely counter to the usual narrative that we hear about the 1930s. And things in the northern mine regions started going counter to the rest of the country even earlier than that. Because in the 1920s, of course, our country had this great economic boom for a lot of people, especially people in the metropolitan areas, or people leaving rural areas and moving to the metropolitan areas. And what drove that boom after World War I was especially what they called new industries, the new technologies, mostly centered around electronics, new appliances, and of course around automobiles. And what drove that economy was copper. They needed copper wire for all these new kinds of products that people were bringing into their homes, the most obvious one being the radio. As a consequence of investment capital moving to copper, it moved out of gold mining. So gold mining was depressed through the 1920s. And places that were dependent upon gold mining, because it was really the only major industry that they had, like the Northern Mines region, were depressed during the 1920s. Grass Valley and Nevada City were kind of sleeping little places, kind of museum relics of towns. And the young people especially were all moving to the urban centers. And one of these people who moved from Grass Valley to San Francisco was a young woman named Doris Hooper. Her father was a millman at the Empire Mine in Grass Valley, which meant that he was in a trusted position because those are the men who actually had an opportunity to put their hands on refined gold. So they had to be trusted men. Doris went down to San Francisco. She lived with her cousins down there. She knew so many Grass Valley people who had moved to San Francisco, but they were in a completely different world because gone was a small town life. Gone was everyone knowing who you were and who your parents were and being able to report back to your family any infractions, large or small. And Doris loved the freedom of riding on the cable cars, going out at night, having places that were open, dances that went on late at night. But she was no flapper. She was still a devout Methodist girl. Her skirts were short, but modestly so. She wore some rouge and some lipstick, which was new and sort of went with the urban lifestyle. But she still went to church regularly on Sundays. My grandfather was another such person. He had grown up in Grass Valley and spent his young life in Therese's variety store, where they had comic books and magazines of all kinds and toys and things. And on account of him living next door to the Therese family, he was able to look at all the comic books without buying them. They thought Goldie and George Therese encouraged my grandfather. They thought he was going to grow up to be an attorney because he obviously liked reading so much. In fact, he wanted to be a cartoonist. And so he went to San Francisco and got himself a job drawing illustrations back when they were still hand-drawn for newspapers, and got himself a job as an illustrator and a cartoonist on a San Francisco newspaper. Everything dramatically changed for the country, of course, and we think of it as being with the stock market crash of October of 1929. And the real story economically is what followed the crash. And what followed the crash was a period of deflation, which is when money becomes worth more rather than the inflation that we're most accustomed to. And the impacts on the country were just devastating. We went through a terrible time and are still going through it in 2008-2009. And what happened during that period was the GNP, the gross domestic product shrunk by 3%. And so we all know, and we all have experience in our families or among people we know, what the impact of that has been on this country since the fall of 2008. Between 1929 and 1932, the GNP fell 25%. Industrial output fell by approximately 50%. New construction fell by 78%. Of course, 25% of the workforce was unemployed. Now, we've got some pockets in California, some rural counties, where you can find something in the neighborhood of 20% unemployment. Nevada County got up to about 12%, but 25% is something that I think most of us in our lifetime have never seen anything like that. In Nevada County, gold mining employment had fallen by 1929 to its lowest level since the gold rush of 1849 and the early 1850s. There are only about 500 mining jobs in Nevada County. What capital survived the crash was looking for a safe harbor. And in those years when currencies were paid to the price of gold, there's no safer thing to be invested in than gold. And so slowly at first and increasingly over the decade of the 1930s, investment money moved from places where it had been, especially copper and electronics and Wall Street in general, into gold mining. And as early as 1930, actually by the summer of 1930, people began to feel this in Grass Valley and Nevada City. And the effect was sort of like of these people, because they knew the country was in a terrible state as 1930 began, and as unemployed men were selling apples on street corners and such things. And they had the effect of sort of like someone who hears a gun go off, and then you kind of check and you say, well, I'm not hit, so I must be okay. And that's the experience they had in Grass Valley. They slowly realized, we don't seem to be feeling this so much. And then they started to see that all of the mines that had been opened in the 20s, some of which had closed recently, were reopening. And investment money was pouring in. And one sign of this was, any place in this country, if you wanted to go stay in a hotel, if you were one of the people who could afford to go stay in a hotel, no reservations required. Just walk in the best hotel in New York City or San Francisco or any place else. Just walk in and get a very good room. In Grass Valley, you had to wire ahead to get a room. And people who turned up, as some mining engineers did, and one journalist who recorded this fact did, who showed up without reservations, ended up wandering around at night trying to find any place, some place to lodge. Mining employment started to grow in Grass Valley, Nevada City, at the rate of 100 jobs a month. And these are manufacturing jobs. So the impact of one of these jobs, of a manufacturing job, the ripple effect through the economy, is that it creates 6 or 7 or 8 other jobs. So for every miner, you needed a certain number of barbers and cobblers and butchers and grocers and so forth. And those are the jobs that started to ripple through the Northern Mines area. And they had a tremendous housing boom, because with these jobs, there were people coming in and there were not enough places to put them. And so while construction was virtually dead in the rest of the country, in Grass Valley and Nevada City, the contractors and the builders could not keep up with the demand, and they were working pretty much 2 shifts or as long as they had daylight to work. A new lumber yard opened up. There were already two existing lumber yards with sawmills. A third lumber yard opened up. Its specialty was that it was open all night. So if you were a miner, you could get off your shift in the middle of the night and drive out to the lumber yard at Chicago Park and buy your lumber in the middle of the night and go home and add on to or fix up your house or whatever kind of lean-to it was that you were trying to get buy-in until you could get some proper housing. Now, all of this had a big impact on the Cornish, not only in that area, but the Cornish all across the country. Because one thing that, especially with daily newspapers in Grass Valley and Nevada City, one thing that the newspapers there and the people there were concerned about was not encouraging a lot of people to come in. They had a good thing going, and they didn't want to be overrun and have people come in and spoil it. And so they talked about prosperity broadcasting. We don't want prosperity broadcasting. Do not write, and these would actually be, in editorials in the newspaper. Do not write to your relatives in other parts of the country and tell them to come here. The Chamber of Commerce was just getting hundreds of letters, literally hundreds, every day from people all across the country who had heard something about a boom in this area and wanted to know about job opportunities. The job opportunities were for people with skills in hard rock mining. And those people were welcome. And they came especially from the copper camps. We had a nice talk at St. Pierre's Day last March from Gary Noy, who teaches at Sierra College. And his Cornish ancestors were in Butte, Montana. And they heard about Grass Valley. And that's how his Noy ancestors got to Grass Valley in around 1930, 1931, because things had completely collapsed up in Butte. Others came from Arizona and from the northern Michigan area and from other mining regions. And when they were recognized as hard rock miners, which is to say, when they were recognized as being Cornish, they were helped, they were directed who to go talk to at the mine. And at the mines, they would have what they called rustling lines every morning. And unemployed men would go out and stand in front of the office. And the superintendent would come out and go down the line and conduct little interviews. And if you could say that you had been mining in Butte or in Calumet, Michigan, or you had run an air a drill in Jerome, Arizona, or run a pump in St. Just, or other kinds of skills that you could reference, you could pretty much get on right away. If you said you had been working on a ranch, or building fences on a farm, or some other kind of agricultural employment, well, then your best bet was probably to go down to the creeks, where a lot of people during that period tried to get by doing placer mining. That is mining. That is working the creeks with picks and pans. So for the Cornish, they were welcomed into Grass Valley, and they came from all over the country, and found there Cornish community. I'm distracted because I've got the same dial. I've got the same ringtone on my phone. And but there were still Cornish people even at that time coming from Cornwall itself, because we think of the great period of migration as being from 1815, the end of the wars in Europe, and 1914, the beginning of the First World War. But even in the late 1920s and 30s, there were still people coming from Cornwall. And a couple of them were young men, they were about 19 years old, who came from St. Just. And one was named John Hollow, and his friend was Ed Farley. And we're not quite sure how much education they had. Maybe a couple of years in school, maybe as many as 4 or 5 years in school, probably nothing more than that. Regular attendance at Methodist Sunday School, which was took up most of the day and did teach a lot of reading and writing and math skills, as long as biblical literacy. And these men came over following, as the Cornish always did in any era, following a chain of migration. And they came to Michigan, where they each had uncles. They sailed on a ship out of Liverpool. They were with a group of about 8 Cornishmen about their age. Sailed on a trip out of Liverpool. And the passage in those years wasn't all that bad. I mean, the days of steerage and being down in the hold of the ship and in dreadful conditions had passed, and John Hollow saved some souvenirs from the trip, including the menu that looked very appetizing, and included a fresh halibut and pork and chicken and walnuts and for a dessert, and he shared a room with his friend Ed Hollow. And so they got to Michigan, Detroit, and Flint, respectively, and of course found, this was 1930, found there were no jobs, and people were lined up outside of the automobile factories hoping to get jobs. And so John Hollow pressed on to Ely, Minnesota, which was iron mining. And there were jobs there, and if you've been to Ely, as many of us have been, because the Cornish American Heritage Society had a gathering there a number of years ago, it's a beautiful spot in the summer. It's on what they call the boundary wilderness between the USA and Canada, which is a whole series of streams and lakes and wonderful for outdoor recreation. But the winters, which go on for a very long time, are especially brutal. But John Hollow got a job there, wrote to his friend Ed Farley in Flint and said, come on over to Ely, there's work here. And so they both got jobs. John Hollow lived in a boarding house, and the boarding house in Ely were the type of boarding houses, even at that time, where you got very hearty meals, 3 meals a day, but then you also shared a bunk in shifts, because there were at least 2, sometimes 3 shifts at the mine, so there was always someone working and someone in the bunk back at the boarding house. Ed Farley had a little better accommodations because he stayed with his old Sunday school teacher from St. Just, who had a house. But generally, Ed Farley's luck was pretty bad. He was hurt in a mine accident, had a concussion, couldn't work for a number of months, became depressed, thought about going back to Cornwall, and was seen through it by his old Sunday school teacher, who nursed him through it. In the meantime, John Hollow had pressed on to Grass Valley, where another uncle had written to him, when he wasn't supposed to be prosperity broadcasting. And so Hollow, in turn, wrote to Ed Farley. They both ended up in Grass Valley. Ed Hollow's luck was altogether better because while in Ely, he met a very pretty Swedish girl. And her father was a carpenter from Sweden, and he built the canoes that were sold or rented to the recreationers who came up to be in this border country and to go fishing during during the summer. And so Ed Hollow eventually went back to Ely, married this girl, took her to Grass Valley. They were able to buy a house and then eventually have her father come out from Ely. And so a man from Ely came out to build a house in Grass Valley for them because there was so little housing to be had. Ed Farley went on especially to become a well-known in the Methodist Church as a vocalist and to become a leader in the Masonic Lodge in Grass Valley, where he was a leader of that lodge for over 50 years. Ed Hollow became the leader of the Salvation Army Band in Grass Valley. He had come to Grass Valley with two letters of recommendations from back in St. Just. One said that he was a terrific underground miner, and the other said he was a very reliable tuba player. Now, he's not sure which of these letters he valued the most, but they, wherever he went, they served him well because he was always working, got a job underground right away, and had a place in the town band. And then they both, of course, sang in the Grass Valley Carol Choir for many years. Ed Hollow was president of the Carol Choir. So some new Cornish people were coming in, but the people who were mostly coming in were people with other backgrounds. Some of them were returning natives, like my grandfather, who had no experience of mining. But while in San Francisco, he married a woman, and part of what connected them from the beginning was that her family owned a gold mine in Allegheny, not too far up the slope from Grass Valley. And between Grass Valley and Allegheny, there was always an exchange of technology and workers and managers. And so when the Depression hit, my grandfather lost his job with the newspaper. He was driving a cab, lost that job eventually. And so there was nothing else to do but go up to the family property in Allegheny, where at least there was a big house, and there was something that might be gainful employment with the gold mine, that they could operate themselves on a very modest scale. And there was fishing, and there was hunting. Of course, my grandfather had none of these skills, didn't fish, didn't hunt, but he picked them up quickly, became a very good woodsman. In Allegheny, the pasties were filled with venison because the deer were plentiful. And my mother, as a young child, knew venison in all its forms and configurations because that's what got them through, especially through those very hard lean years, 1930, 31, 32. And also there, my grandfather learned how to work underground. And so he worked at the family mine, developed his skills until he could get on at the 16-to-1 mine, which is still open in Allegheny. And then with that on his resume, he could go down to the Idaho, Maryland mine, where his Cornish grandfather had worked and where his cousin still worked, and get a job in Grass Valley, and then my mother could go to the Grass Valley schools. A lot of natives like my grandfather, a lot of the young people who left in the 20s found themselves coming back in the 1930s. And this is a major theme of the 1930s in this country. And a place where you see this theme, you see it very much in the kind of the iconic movie of that age, Gone with the Wind, which is a story of a woman going back to the family plantation. But there is also a Shirley Temple movie called Heidi, made in about 1936. And my mother identified it very closely because Heidi went back to her family roots, left the city as a girl. She was sort of abandoned as a child. Went back to live with her grandfather in the Alps, in this small alpine village. To my mother, her own story of going to live in the mountains seemed very much like Heidi's story. And the key moment in the movie Heidi is when the grandfather, who has refused to go to church for as long as anybody in the village can remember, decides that Heidi needs to know something about the Bible. And so he reads her the story of the prodigal son, who, of course, was a son who went off to the metropolitan areas, went off to the boom and the new economy and all those things that people marveled at in the 20s, and, of course, throughout all human history. And when it all collapsed, the prodigal son goes home too. So that's sort of the large theme of the 1930s. With these people coming back, and with so many different people coming into the county, because it was not only Cornish miners who had the skills and were coming to Grass Valley, Nevada City, but there were Yugoslavian miners, and there were Italian miners, and there were miners from other ethnic groups in Europe getting on there. And then there were the occasional people who somehow got a break, usually because they knew someone or somehow got connected, maybe through church or through a lodge or something, and they got on and became miners themselves. So the population of Nevada County in 1930 was 10,000, and before 1940 it had more than doubled. It was more than 20,000 people. So there were all these people packed in to those two towns. So while the Cornish were still a dominant group by their numbers were diluted by all these other people coming in. And then, of course, their numbers were falling off. Their members were fading away. And some of those who were leaving the scene in the 1930s were Cornish people who had been a very big part of Grass Valley, such as a woman named Ellen Ellis, who was a dressmaker and virtually taught dressmaking to every girl who grew up in Grass Valley for more than a generation. And everyone in town knew her. Harry Sparnan from Red Ruth, who was a barber in town. He had the oldest continuing shop on Mill Street in Grass Valley, also a great sportsman and fisherman. Simon Praise, who was a pillar of the Methodist Church, gave the organ that is still in the Grass Valley Methodist Church today, and was a leader of the Salvation Army and a local preacher. This whole group of men, known as the Old Idaho Miners, my grandfather's grandfather was one of them, and it confused me a long time, the Old Idaho Miners. I was looking for their roots in Idaho or someplace, along the Boise River or something. No, they were all men from Red Ruth and Illugan, who worked at the Idaho mine in Grass Valley before it merged with the Maryland to form the Idaho-Maryland mine. So those were the old Idaho miners. And as these old fellows would pass away, the obituary would typically open with words like, "Another of the old Idaho crew has gone on to glory." The old guard of the Methodist Church was fading away, and just my favorite couple from that old guard were Emma and Edward Richards, who were from Guinier, Cornwall. They met there as young people and hoped to marry, but circumstances in Cornwall being what they were, they didn't. Edward went on to Grass Valley. Emma later followed. They were married in Grass Valley, married for almost 50 years, for almost 60 years. And then, as the newspaper reported, died hand in hand. Wasn't quite hand in hand, but they did actually die within hours of one another. Had a joint funeral, a joint eulogy by the Methodist pastor, and buried in the historic cemetery in Grass Valley. The 1930s was the sort of the last period, although we've had something of a revival of this, but the last period when you could regularly find stories in the Grass Valley newspaper about conditions in Cornwall. You find articles about the fishing industry and how it was faring in Cornwall in the 1930s. The editor, Edmund Kenyon, would review any book about Cornwall that he could get his hands on. The pastor of the Methodist Church would give sermons in which he would compare Methodism in America to Methodism in Cornwall. Always one suspects with a hint that we should be more like the Cornish and be more faithful. In our church activities. And then there were famous people in town like Minnie Benalik Adams, who was known as the Angel of Mill Street. And she was, before nursing was a professional occupation or widely available as a professional occupation, she was a practical nurse. She worked as a practical nurse, usually hired by families. But she continued with this work long after she was doing it for gainful employment. And if you know Grass Valley, Mill Street runs from the center of town all the way out to where some of the earliest mining was and where the Gold Hill, where gold was discovered in a region called Boston Ravine. And so from Mill Street to Boston Ravine, any family that had sickness or tragedy, Minnie was there. She was in their home cooking meals, taking care of people, taking care of orphans, getting them situated with the Catholic orphanage right there in Grass Valley. She was really, before there were social workers, before there were public health nurses, there was a Cornish woman taking care of great numbers of people. Well, it was, by many accounts, the 1930s was a wonderful time in Grass Valley, Nevada City. As one man who I interviewed said, if your kid needed a pair of shoes, you had the money to go buy a pair of shoes. As another one said, these were boom years. These were the best of years. And a man who worked at the lumberyard, where he dealt with Cornish miners day and night, told me that never in the whole period did he have, was he ever short of money. He always had enough money for whatever he needed to buy. This all began to unravel when the war started in Europe in 1939. And Grass Valley especially, and Nevada City with their large Cornish populations, were very much affected by that psychologically. The war started in 39. There was this period known as the Phony War in late 39, and then the pounding of Britain by German aircraft really began in 1940, and the reports would come back to Grass Valley, and what was anecdotal reports, because it wouldn't be in the newspaper because you didn't want to tip off the enemy to how successful their bombing raids may have been, So it would come back as anecdotal stories from people who were in Cornwall and anxious to get back to the United States. Several people who were there visiting with family and things and came back and told of this tremendous bombing of Plymouth and Falmouth and the other, especially harbors and naval facilities in Devon and Cornwall. And the Christmas of 1940 in Grass Valley really had a pall over it because people were so aware of what their folks were going through over home. At the same time, in the rest of the country, and especially in the rest of California, our aircraft manufacturers, I think Lockheed, the company that I worked for, was the first, started getting contracts from the British government to build fighter planes. And so there was plenty of jobs suddenly in aircraft. And then once we got into the war as combatants, after serving for a period of months at the arsenal of democracy, once we actually got into the fight, then the war industries were really going full bore, and they were paying more than the gold mine. And so many of the men from Grass Valley who had been working in the mines went into war industry jobs. Some of the first of them, a crew of about 30, mostly Cornishmen, went to work for what became Bechtel Corporation in Hawaii. They went to Pearl Harbor after the raid on Pearl Harbor to help in rebuilding, but especially to do tunneling and build underground bunkers at Pearl Harbor. Most of the others went into shipbuilding all through the Bay Area. Went to the naval shipyard at Mare Island. My grandfather, my uncle, most of my family went to the Joshua Hendy plant. Joshua Hendy was a Cornish engineer from Morenstow who started the big iron works in San Francisco, eventually moved to Sunnyvale. And many that my family knew went to Joshua Hendy Iron Works in Sunnyvale, where they were building the engines for the Liberty ships and working three shifts pretty much all through the war. And then in October of 1942, an order came down from Washington from the War Industry Board that said that gold mining was a non-essential industry. And so order L-208 closed the gold mines for the rest of the Second World War. So anyone who was still working in the mines, by then many had left, were obliged to probably to go down to the Bay Area and find a job in the war industries, or to go just over the county line to Yuba County, where Camp Beale was being built, and men were getting on at $10 a day, where the mines had been paying for the highest skill level, maybe $5.75 a day. So it all came unraveled as the rest of the country was sort of picking up because of all of the war industry, Grass Valley, Nevada City, the northern mines were going again into a state of decline. And although mining began after the war, again, never on the same level, there were 40 gold mines operating in Grass Valley and Nevada City in the 1930s. There were only a handful after 1945, and of course the last of them closed in 1956. And so what was going on in Grass Valley and Nevada City was all the way through contrary to what was going on in the rest of the country. And when I thought about talking about extracting from my book the Cornish story out of it, and you think, well, This is going to be a smaller story that I'm going to extract. But in many ways, it's actually a bigger story, because it's the story of the Cornish responding throughout their history since industrialization, especially to the influence of markets and technology and government policy. And so when, after the wars with Napoleon, and there were free markets and transportation around the world, courtesy largely of the Royal Navy, who kept the shipping lanes free and open. The tremendous impact on Cornwall, because it opened up all these new sources of copper and tin, especially in Southeast Asia, that made mining in Cornwall no longer able to compete. And so that did a lot to trigger the great migration that our families were mostly all part of. And not only the Cornish, but of course this was happening all over Europe. It was happening with, take for example, the Italians in Sicily. They had been the wheat-growing area of Southern Europe. All of Southern Europe, all of that wonderful pasta was from wheat from Sicily. After 1815, with these markets, these global markets opening up, they could not compete with the wheat coming out of Russia. And so it triggered their migration to Australia and Canada, and most especially the USA and South America. And you see this in all of the ancient people of Europe, in all of the regions of Europe. These responses to markets triggered things. And then often government policy played a part. In Italy, it played a part by, Italy was just interested in developing manufacturing. They wanted the new technologies, did nothing to help their agricultural base. And so this spurred more people to leave. So this trend goes on, and we see it in the 20s, where new technologies and new markets changed where the Cornish had opportunities, and then changing markets again, government policy, especially the Roosevelt administration raising the price of gold up to 30, letting it float for about a year, which was very beneficial to Grass Valley, and then eventually paying them at $35 an ounce, had a big impact on then the investment money just surged into Grass Valley, Nevada City. So anyway, it goes on, and so it's actually a much bigger story when one looks at it as our folk being among a whole lot of folk who were impacted during the same period of time, reacted to it. And thank God for our folk, because they reacted really well. So I would be happy to take any questions and about what I've talked about, or about the 1930s in general. The book is $30, and there's a few copies here, and there's a couple copies of my previous book, which I think most people here probably already have. Any questions or any stories of the 1930s anyone would like to share?
I have a question. So looking at the church up there, was that built during that boom, the Methodist church?
It was.
I was just thinking, it's kind of that and it's such a big, beautiful church, it would make sense if that's when it grew to that size.
Of course, there were previous churches on
right,
the land.
But that particular building looked like the 30s.
And the original, not the original, but the Methodist church that was there the longest, sort of looked like a New England church. Many of the churches in the Gold Country were
designed by people who had experience back east, and so things sometimes looked like back east. Sometimes, like Emmanuel Church, they looked like Britain. Or sometimes they looked like the east coast of the U.S. But in 1936, they had a spectacular Methodist church fire. The whole place burned down. The janitor left an oil lamp burning, is what they think the cause was. And the whole place burned down. And the biggest fire Grass Valley had ever seen. And then this huge, huge steeple going way up high just went up like a growing candle. And before the ashes were cool, a Cornishman who worked for the newspaper, Henry Argall, began collecting money to build a new church. And that's the church that we know now. And it's built in a mission style, which was, of course, completely different from anything that had been there previously. And but it does go to show there was a lot of federal money that came in, especially to Nevada City in the 30s, because their congressman, Harry Engelbreit, was the Republican whip in the House of Representatives. And he had such a safe seat. He had survived after Hoover and the Republicans just took a tremendous beating, the beating of the century, in the 1932 election that elected Franklin Roosevelt. Harry Engelbreit survived, so he became Republican whip. Now, of course, he wasn't a Democrat. He wasn't of Mr. Roosevelt's party. But Mr. Roosevelt wanted to, there were congressmen who he wanted to keep sweet. And he didn't want any hard feelings between he and Harry Engelbreit. And so the federal money flowed pretty well into Nevada City. There were six CCC camps nearby, Civilian Conservation Corps. There was a new post office. There was a new elementary school, a new courthouse, or a remodeled courthouse, a new city hall. In those days, it was actually much like these days. It was all matching funds. You had to put up about half of the money funds. But at the same time, there was so much private building also going on. And the Methodist Church is a very good example of that. The new Masonic Lodge building, all built with private funds in the 1930s in Grass Valley. The Grass Valley Veterans Building, which we used last summer for our gathering, was built with private money. And it was referred to as Cousin Jack's Cousin Jack WPA, Work Progress Administration, was a work relief agency of the Roosevelt administration. But Cousin Jack WPA meant it was all done privately, and it was mostly done by Cousin Jack's working after the shift was over at the mine. Because there was a lot of free labor went into that building. And then, of course, the Del Oro Theater in the Grass Valley was a great thing that opened just as America got into World War II.
That's really interesting about the CCC.
Yes.
Because according to Professor Rose's book of the Cornish in America, at the time he wrote it, there had only been one Cornish American U.S. senator. That was my grandfather's first cousin, Albert Duncan Thomas from Utah. And I knew, because we always talked about it at home, and I followed the debates in Congress when he carried the GI Bill. But I didn't know about his previous history, which was he also carried. He was one of those people who was a Republican, but Roosevelt kept him on hand. He carried the legislation for the CCC and the 8-hour day.
And he worked very closely with Harry Engelbreit and the senator from Nevada in trying to resist this order L-208 that closed the gold mine. And they were three who teamed up and tried to pressure the president and anyone else who who they could apply pressure to try to resist that order to close the mine. I'll just tell you a funny story that I learned after the book was published. A family from Grass Valley, and this must have been 1936 or something, went to Washington, D.C. on a summer vacation, drove back there, and the man, Mr. Dubrow, was president of the local water district. And they went back to Washington, D.C., and when you went to Washington, D.C., you went to see your local congressman, and he gave you, not some staffer, he gave you a tour of the Capitol and so forth. So they did that. Harry Engelbreit was there. But the president was out. He was down in Warm Springs or someplace in Georgia where he liked the vacation. And so they went to the White House to meet the president, but he wasn't available. But the secretary said, oh, well, you can go in and look at his office. And so they walked in, they walked around his office and looked at the pictures on the wall, and looked at the desk, and looked at some memos and some notes he had there, and just kind of wandered around until they got their fill, and then they went back to the hotel. It just shows you what a different way of life. It was 80 years ago, and what a very different way of life. Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you all, talking about the book, and of course, talking about the heritage that we're here to celebrate. Yes, Janet.
I was going to mention, I bought two copies and sent one to my uncle Bill Rickard, who lives in Auburn, grew up in Tennessee, and he did a Christmas card collection. He said he sat down and went through the whole thing and just really enjoyed it. He grew up there. He was born in 1923, and so grew up, you know, a kid very impressed and everything. He saw all this. He remembered a lot of the names in there, and he just really enjoyed it.
I get some lovely letters from people of your uncle's age and who recognize all of the names and the places and things like that.
And
it brings back a lot of memories.
Gathering last year, and I introduced them to you, and Joe Day was their his best man at the wedding.
Right. Joe Day, who just retired from the Carol Choir after singing with the choir more than 50 years. Well, thank you all.